So I will start. I guess I'll start this way with Dina. Okay. Dina Zingaro. Dina.
First started working at CBS News after graduation as a researcher for the evening news and then the weekend evening news. And for the last 2.5 years, she's worked for anchor and correspondent Scott Kelly as the broadcast associate for the evening news and 60 Minutes. She's responsible for his research, for his daily broadcasts and his interviews. Dina also pitches and associate produces stories for both shows. Dina has developed a portfolio of stories centered on and incorporating the topic of religion, including a panel of Muslim millennials in the wake of the San Bernardino and Paris attacks, a 60 Minutes story about the presidential election in Ohio, and evening news stories about Muslim comedian Mo Amer, and one about his story, Episcopal Church offering prayer space to 300 Muslims. And we look forward to hearing more from you.
Martha Moraza, I'm going this way, because, yeah.
Graduated from Swarthmore in 2009 with an honors major in religion and an honors minor in political science. Her senior thesis examined Muslim immigration to Italy, specifically exploring how the interactions between religious and religious communities affected the national conversation about immigration in Italy. After graduation, Martha worked in constituent services for Congressman Chris Mulholland, where she managed the congressman's immigration portfolio. Martha received a master's in refugee and forced migration studies from Oxford University in 2012. From there, she moved to Kenya, where she worked in refugee resettlement for 2 years, conducting interviews with refugees in urban and rural refugee camp settings to determine their eligibility for resettlement in the U.S. In January 2015, Martha joined the State Department's Bureau of International Organizational Affairs, where she works on humanitarian policy issues. Lauren Cardenas is an alumna of Swarthmore College class of 2012, where she majored in religion with research interests in possession traditions and community healing. During her undergraduate year, she served as facilitator for Swarthmore Women of Color Collective and Dimensions of Diversity program hosted by Swarthmore, Bryn Mawr, and Haverford College. Lauren has worked for Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania and the Allowed Public Lecture program hosted by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. She's currently a career program manager at the Posse Foundation, a leadership development program that sends talented high school students in cohorts to top colleges and universities across the country with full tuition-based merit scholarships. Outside of Posse, Lauren freelances as an illustrator, and her hobbies include eating at San Gabriel Valley dim sum houses. So what I want to do right now is just let our panelists say a little bit about themselves, and you guys can decide who goes first.
Okay.
Dina has visuals, so do you want to step up?
Yeah. Sure.
I'm going to hang out over here.
Okay.
Can I?
Yeah.
All right. It's a big seat to build. I'll try.
So ever since I did it at CBS, I always get odd looks when I tell people that, you know, they ask what major I was in college as journalism, communications, and I say religion, and I always get this really shocked look. But to me, it's always been a really natural occurrence. I mean, especially when we think about the election, I see religion playing out in so many ways. So the question for me hasn't been, you know, what religion stories can I find? Every story you look at, it's what is the value system, what is the belief system that's being challenged, that's being defended, that's informing this character, this person who's telling my story. So to me, it's always kind of making sense. So I'm just going to quickly tell you a little bit about what I actually do at CBS. So Don Hewitt, he was the creator of 60 Minutes, and he always would say that our job is to find people who can tell a story better than we ever could. Because TV journalism is different than print journalism. Print journalism, you find people, you interview them, and then you write the words. TV is a little different in that you have to find people that can, because everyone has, most people have a good story, but not everyone can tell their story. And when you think about it, it's kind of a hard thing to do. So my job, you know, for example, we did a piece about the election out in Ohio, and so the heads of 60 Minutes come to us and they say, we want a piece about the election. That's it. And then 6-7 months later, you screen the piece. And so it's our job to do the research, find the place, find the characters, find those voices that are going to make it come to life. And I have found that being a religion major has made that possible, and I see so many ways. And so I guess I'll start in the most obvious and very early example of how my religious study education appeared in the newsroom. This is when I was a researcher for the Evening News, and we were breaking into a special report, which is a decision that's made by the higher-ups if, you know, something happens and we're going to break into regular programming. And I think it was President Obama who was giving a news conference about ISIS. And there I saw a definition of Sharia law. And it, you know, a couple months out of Tariq's classes, and red flag went up. And I remember I emailed Tariq right away, and we went back and forth about how to, you know, put together a working definition. So I went up to the head writer, and I said, all right, here's, you know, three paragraph explanation of what Sharia law is. And he said, Dina, you know, we need 5 words. This is great, we need 5 words. And, you know, you can imagine the shock on my face, but we ended up getting something together that was just more accurate. And I think being a religion major, you learn the importance of nuance, you learn the importance of language. Especially in a newsroom like Evening News that's moving at such a fast pace, you know, you have to slow down. You have to look at words, because words matter. And especially like those sort of terms that get, especially in this news cycle, get thrown around, and they make a big impact. The second thing I want to talk about is the power of images. I come from a Greek Orthodox household, so iconography is not, the importance of it is not lost on me. But working in TV, you are taught, you know, my correspondent Scott Pelley will never write a script until, you know, he has seen the footage, he has seen the B-roll that we bring in, because your words have to marry the images. So imagery is so important. So I have 3 examples, they're very, very short. I just pulled them out of some of the pieces that we've done. The first one that you're gonna see is about Captain Singh. He's the first active duty Sikh soldier to receive religious accommodation just last year, to wear a turban and grow his beard. And I felt that, you know, I'll play it first and then I'll tell you what I think.
Last February, after a decade of service that included being awarded a Bronze Star for Valor for defusing IEDs in Afghanistan, Singh decided to stand up for his beliefs. He took the army to court, seeking a religious accommodation to wear his turban and grow a beard. He won. When you got word that day, what was that like?
After 10 years, I was like, wow, it finally happened, and I was extremely excited about it.
So, you know, part of the piece was Captain Singh talking about when he went to West Point when he was 18 years old and going right to the barbershop and getting his, you know, beard shaven off and kind of trying to reconcile his understanding of his whole life of being a good Sikh. And now, you know, for him, being a good Sikh and being a good military officer, those values are right in line. But what I thought was so interesting was that image of a camo turban and someone wrapping that. I mean, most people haven't seen that. And so putting that on television, I felt, was kind of a unique image that I thought was powerful. The second clip. So this is a church. Tariq mentioned it in the intro. It's a church that we found in the heart of D.C. Friday prayers, 300 Muslims walked in and set up their prayer rugs, because it's one of the biggest, it's called the Adams Center, and they have thousands and thousands of members, so they don't have enough space in their own mosque, so they rent out spaces in synagogues and mosques, and I'm sorry, not mosques, in churches. So this church, you know, rents out their prayer space to them. And I'll play it. And
Look at that. I'm not a Christian, but I look at that. That's beautiful.
And during the prayers, we heard a sound, church bells.
It's amazing, you know, it's amazing to see two things together. You know, who can imagine, you know, church bells ringing and a Muslim giving a sermon? It's a moment of reflection for people who think that we are different. We are all the same. We are all the same.
Interestingly enough, the gentleman they saw at the beginning is actually homeless. He's a convert from Christianity to Islam. And so this was during Ramadan, and gentleman Wadood, who introed that clip, he actually also fasts. So when you think about, he actually talked about the beauty of Ramadan is, you know, for someone like him, he always knows he's going to find food every night, even though he's homeless. He knows there will be Muslims that he can join, his fellow Muslims, and get a meal every night. And so for me, it was that moment when we were in the church, you know, as a producer, you're sitting there, and you're watching these prostrations happen, and you hear Allahu Akbar, and then you hear church bells ringing at the same time, and that was perfect, because, you know, you can, you know, I really believe that you can talk at people all you want and tell them, you know, Muslims are peaceful, but when you have an image like that, I think it can be striking for some. And the third clip is a piece, this is going back a while, but it's a panel that we did right after the Paris attacks in San Bernardino. There was, you know, Muslim safety guides popping up all over. There was a lot of, you know, kickback even in New York, you know, a lot of hate crimes going up against Muslims in the city. And so what we did was we got together a panel of Muslim millennials, a generation of Muslims that only knew what it was like to be Muslim post 9/11. And so Scott, my correspondent, sat down with a group of men.
Show of hands, how many of you were born in the United States? Everybody. In a recent poll done by the Public Religion Research Institute, 56% of the Americans they talked to said that the values of Islam are at odds with American values. How does that strike you?
I mean, I think it's absolutely absurd for anybody to say that anyway, because we were raised in a way where we believe that you were supposed to follow the law and the values of the land that you live in, and we were born and raised here.
What do you think people misunderstand about the values of Islam?
I think they believe too much that the religion places an emphasis on violence.
Sabine?
It's the person that's violent, not the religion.
Arjun?
And when you nitpick a certain religion, or you try and find out certain verses from any sort of text, you're going to find the violent verses. The Quran was written in Arabic, which is a deeply metaphorical language where one word has hundreds of meanings. So if you want to define it in a violent sense, you're going to be able to define it in a violent sense the same way if you want to define it in a peaceful sense, which 1.5 billion people do, you're going to be able to do so.
But there are no verses in the Quran that allow killing of innocent people under any circumstances.
Terrorism in your view is outlawed.
It's outlawed. It's the last thing any Muslim should be doing.
So to me, one of the things that we tried to do, even though it was only 5 people, was try and show diversity of people who identify as Muslim. You know, we had a young black woman who had so much to say about, it was very interesting to talk about, you know, all these different identities that she identifies with. And she had a very unique perspective. And then RJ, the young man in the top left, he's, you know, a Palestinian from Las Vegas. And, you know, we had hijabis in there, women who didn't wear hijabs. And so with this piece, we really tried to show, you know, through the image of seeing, you know, we say there are power in numbers. And I think in that image, that snapshot, you know, we're limited, but I think we can get a little bit of that diversity across. The other thing that we talk a lot about in religious studies that has translated for me as being a TV producer is this idea of sacred space. You know, when we talk about temples, churches, mosques, I think here in religious studies across the board, we also talk about the flexibility of sacred space and how it doesn't have to be in a building. It can be, you know, in all different types of places. And it really struck me when we did our 60-minute piece out in Ohio in the fall, and the 60 minutes you have the luxury of going somewhere for weeks at a time. So what I did was I lived in Ohio for a month, driving on the Ohio Turnpike, which being a New Yorker who doesn't drive anymore was terrifying. But I ended up meeting 12 steel workers, all voting for Donald Trump, all had voted Democrat in the past. And so I spent a long time with them in their town called Lorain, Ohio, which was known as Steel City, and 13,000 people were employed there in two of the steel plants, which have now both closed down. Only 100 people are working at one of the plants right now. So imagine 13,000 people and now only 100. So it's interesting, but it wasn't until I drove down the main street. So imagine the steel plant is 3 miles long. It's massive. And I'm from New Jersey, North Jersey, and I've never seen a steel plant. So I was shocked. I mean, it's completely hollowed out. There's no one. And you can imagine the hundreds of people walking and clocking in every morning. And the whole town is a ghost town. And I remember talking to one of our steel workers, Carlos, and he basically controlled one building in the entire steel plant. I remember him flipping through his phone, showing me his little control room, which he was so proud of. He talked about, I have my own kitchen in there, I used to have my own bathroom in there, and everyone was always jealous, and he just detailed the control and that he had, and from this, it was almost like he was describing a throne of sorts. It was really fascinating. That's when I realized that for many of these men, they had worked in this space for 30, 40 years. And there I was, we fast forward a year, and I'm standing with these men, they're 50, 60 years old, in a community college courtyard, because after losing their jobs, they're all in retraining programs back in community college. And these are men who are my father's age, who are now wearing backpacks, and they have permission forms that they have to get signed by their teachers, who are probably younger than them, who have to say, yes, you were in class. And they go and hand that in, and they get their pay at the end of the week. It's their form of unemployment. And that idea of sacred space for them being taken away from them, and now they're surrounded by millennials on their college campus. I mean, it was so striking to me. And to be able to understand, perhaps their anger, their reason for voting the way they did, that understanding sacred space, I think, was something that really struck me. And the last thing I'll talk about is, I think in religious studies, you are taught, how religions can hold so many complexities, so many contradictions, so many absurdities, all at once. And being a journalist, and you're telling people stories, you're talking about complex lives, absurd lives, lives that don't make sense, contradictions. And so when we were out in Ohio, part of our story was about two women who went to the same church, both evangelicals, both very, very Republican, very politically active. One woman loved Donald Trump. The other woman could not stand him. And I'll never forget the woman who liked Donald Trump. I asked her, I said, some people may question, your evangelical going for Donald Trump. And she looked at me and said, Dina, I already have a savior, and his name is Jesus Christ. And she was so certain, and it was so striking to me. And then you think, just in the pew over on Sundays, you have the other mother, the other Republican who says, she says, I identify as a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican. And during our 60-minute interview, Scott asked her, do you think, Mr. Trump is faithful? And she said, I'm not one to judge, but judging by his fruit, it stinks a little. And, these women are actually family friends. And it was just fascinating to me that not only a religion, but a church, the same pew could hold such different views, and both women used their religion very specifically with biblical verses. They defended their choice for president, which I thought was so interesting. But I think being religion major prepares you for that, right? I mean, there's the text, there's the religion that has all these ideals, but then there are the believers that live their lives with these contradictions and the beauty's kind of in that space in between. And I think being a reporter is finding that same sort of gray zone where all the interesting things happen. So that's enough for me, but thank you. Thanks for coming.
All right, I'll go next. Love that to follow. So I'm Martha, I graduated in 2009, and I think I'll talk a little bit about why I chose to study religion and kind of what it meant to me when I was here, and then just speak a little bit about more recently how it's come to play in my life, if that's all right. So when I was here, I was telling Mark earlier, when I was here, I decided to study religion sophomore year after taking gender, sexuality, and the body in Islam. I left class every day with a lot more questions than answers, and I actually thought that was a good thing. And I just kept taking religion courses with, you know, everyone from the department and had just an amazing experience. I think religion is a great way to kind of study many things at once. For me, it was a way to study psychology, history, art, culture. And I just thought it was this really unique, very interdisciplinary, actually, lens through which to view the world. And I think kind of the three main things that it's given me since then are empathy, better understanding and empathy for others, definitely the complexity and the variety that exists in the world, and then also just the comparative nature of the study was so key and so relevant for kind of what I've done since then. So I've done a couple things. I mean, I worked for a member of Congress. I thought about journalism, but didn't pursue it. I moved to Kenya. And I think I'll just speak about my time in Kenya when I was doing refugee resettlement work. And then I'll talk more recently about my time at the State Department and how religion has kind of undergirded both of those experiences. So in Kenya, I was working for a U.S. government contractor where I was interviewing refugees for a resettlement to the U.S. So very topical now, but what we would do is the U.N. would interview refugees first, and then if they were extremely vulnerable and they thought they were good candidates for third country resettlement because they weren't safe where they were, they would be referred to countries like the U.S. for third country resettlement. Then our organization would come in, interview people about the persecution they experienced in their country of origin, and after us, the Department of Homeland Security would re-interview the people again. Religion came up all the time. It's one of the five grounds of persecution that's, you know, when determining refugee status. So a lot of people I spoke to were fleeing religious persecution, whether they were Pentecostals in Eritrea or Christians in Somalia, which is extremely, extremely rare. And so a lot of what they were fleeing from was on the basis of practicing their faith, often in secrecy, often in really difficult circumstances. And so having that background and having that knowledge base of different religions and their practices and rituals was extremely helpful. And it was also very personally moving to me to see people who had persisted in practicing their faith under such duress and under such hard circumstances. The other thing when I was working in Kenya, and again, I was based in Kenya, but traveling throughout different countries in the region, is I saw both the way religion was very much unifying, and when people flee, often one of the first things they do when they're in a new country is they seek out people maybe in their same ethnic group who speak their same language or practice their same faith. So I would see Congolese refugees who had fled from the DRC come to Kenya, immediately find a church, and you know, it would be this informal social net, and that was really powerful. And you would even see almost this informal family unification processes happening. So let's say someone's nephew, you know, showed up as an unaccompanied minor in Nairobi, he would make his way to this church, the church would know his uncle, they put him in touch, and they would do this family tracing that was very organic and very moving around these faith-based groups. Unfortunately, though, I also saw, and I think we can all appreciate this, how religion could be very divisive. And like I said, many people were fleeing because of their religion. And then often in camp settings, you would think that refugees who had fled when they were together in a camp would have a shared sense of persecution, and so the camps would be safe. But often the camps were subdivided in ways that were similar, analogous, or parallel to
the divisions in the countries they were fleeing from. So you still saw tensions. You still saw taboos about who marries whom, you know, different people crossing different lines. And so it was really interesting to me, again, both how heartwarming and how faith-based groups and even places of worship could be real sources of asylum and strength, and at the same time how they were causing, or elements of people fleeing. So definitely undergirded everything I did. One more thing about my time in Kenya, and then I'll move on to the State Department, but I think I moved there and I had certain perceptions about the world and the people I'd been speaking with, and I was constantly challenged based on meeting people and their stories. So for example, in the camps I was working in, when dealing with Somali refugees and Ethiopian refugees, some of the families I met with practiced polygamy. In the US, you know, we have this version, I think this conception of polygamy, you think maybe Utah, you know, you think the West, it's a very distinct American view of polygamy. And when I went there, I would talk to these families and, you know, not passing in judgment, but it was very interesting because it wasn't the same conception as we have in the US. There, it was maybe a safety issue. It was a protection issue often. Often a widow in a refugee camp setting with young children would be much more unsafe than as part of a family. So I think having that religious background, having that study and exposure and openness toward different faiths allowed me to be a better and more empathetic interviewer, and definitely allowed me to be more open and engage with people and kind of meet them where they were. At the State Department, religion is also very relevant, but in a different way. So what I do right now, I work at the Bureau of International Organization Affairs, so we do international negotiations. So if there's a big treaty to be signed or a document to be negotiated, we'll help negotiate on behalf of the US. And so when I'm in those positions, when I'm in the chair for the US and when I'm negotiating with people from other countries, I would say that religion and the way it's taught me empathy and maybe a bit of cultural shorthand helps me at least understand or place people that are coming from all over the world. So it's not a catch-all, you know, it's not that, oh, someone's from this country, that means they must believe this, this, and this, and, you know, practice in this, and this way. But again, it gives me maybe a lens or an idea of their tradition or the context from which they're coming from that I think helps very much when you're doing diplomacy. Also, kind of unfortunately, a lot of the crises that I follow, so I do humanitarian policy as well, and a lot of the crises that I follow, there are ethnic lines and kind of ethnic dimensions, but very much religion is at play here too. So, you know, if you look at Yemen, if you look at Syria, if you look at many other conflicts, having an understanding of the different traditions and kind of conceptions and kind of the battles that play out intellectually and sometimes in reality has been very interesting to witness. And so I think I'll leave it there. I know that wasn't quite 10 minutes, but I would say I find it to be an incredibly relevant lens. And it both is always at the back of my mind and sometimes very much at the front of my mind in all that I do, both, I would say, personally and when I meet people and professionally as well.
So when I first came to Swarthmore, I thought I was going to major in English just because that was something I was good at in high school. I enjoyed it. And then I took a couple classes here and I decided, okay, this is not for me. No disrespect to the department or peers in the classes, but I felt like I couldn't really connect to the material. I wasn't really connecting with professors in the way that I wanted to. I randomly, you know, I dropped a course and then I needed to pick up another one to fill that empty spot. And I ended up in Professor Mark Wallace's religion and literature course. And I thought, cool, it's books, it's English still. I'll like it, awesome. And so I get into it and we're reading Black Elk Speaks, we're reading, what else? The Stranger.
Yeah.
I should have read that in high school. I didn't experience it until I got here. And it was just such a wonderful experience because all these questions that had been in my head about, like, what is the nature of my existence and what is my purpose in life, like all of these fundamental questions about just being in the world, which I guess I had always had, I was finally able to just experience and be critical about in that class. And so from there, I knew that I was going to major in religion, and everyone around me was like, okay, cool, so you're gonna be a professor, right? Or like, yeah, you're gonna be a pastor or a priest, right? And I was like, no, I will do whatever I want, and I am doing what I want. More on that later. But I went into it because it was something that I really enjoyed. After that, I was taking religious, I was taking classes that focused on transatlantic African religious traditions with Professor Yvonne Chereau. Incredible courses that exposed me, I think, to ritual and religious iconography and spiritual images. And so one of the research projects I did my first year was on religious slash spiritual images in Los Angeles. And the reason why I chose that for my research project was because growing up in LA, you see, you know, crosses, you see, you know, images from Dia de los Muertos, all sorts of things just exist that are religious in nature, that are spiritual in nature, yet the backdrop that they exist in, you know, it's not inside a church, it's not inside a temple, it's not in these enclosed spaces. And so what I was always really passionate about was how, you know, how religion and spirituality can exist outside of an enclosed space. And so I discovered, well, not discovered, but one of the things that captivated me most in West African religious traditions, specifically in Santeria and in Candomblé, and Haitian Voodoo, actually, which is what I ended up focusing on, was this idea of spirit possession. And so how is spirit possession used in these different communities that practice it? And as I studied and I learned more about it, I discovered that, my theory is rather, that every people, so wherever you are, there is some sort of spirit tradition that exists, like a spirit possession tradition that exists. And whether you, whatever the religious tradition is, like what is that function of that particular ritual? Like what function does it serve? How do people use it? How is that connected to community healing? How is that used as a way for people to air grievances or share messages? So that ended up being my research question when I went abroad in my junior year, and I was in Vietnam and Cambodia. And in Vietnam, Hue is in central Vietnam, and that was known as, that was like the old royal capital of the country prior to the war. And the atmosphere of that city is really interesting. Like when you're there, you can almost feel like there's some sort of like otherworldly presence when you're there, whether that's due to the number of temples that are there, the old imperial city that's there. I was invited to a spirit possession ceremony, and I remember I was in this boat and I was helping lugging like crates of chickens on this boat, and we were on this boat and we're going through like down this river. It's like 2 hours on this little boat, and then we have to climb like through these like this wooded jumbly sort of area, and then we end up at this temple, and this temple was being it was just built, and so I was helping you know, create platters of food and set up all these little, I guess, like material sort of goods, I guess, that they were going to give to their spirits. And it was a really fascinating experience because when the ritual started, I met the spirit mediums that came. There was a dozen different spirit mediums, men and women, who were there. And, you know, they're dressed in all this regalia that looks like imperial, like Vietnamese sort of royalty. So they have these big elaborate headdresses, these beautiful golden and red robes. And so we're all sitting there, it's like midnight, we're all sitting there, and then, you know, one by one, each priest, rather each medium comes up, and then they do this a particular dance. And whatever dance or, you know, physical expression they were doing was meant to be, you know, that corresponded to a particular spirit that was coming down, and so they were sharing a message. So there was one person who was this older gentleman who was dancing with swords, and there was this other woman who was dancing with incense and fire in her hands. And it was incredible to watch. And when I would tell people about my research, they're like, oh, well, do you believe in that? Do you believe they were really possessed? And it's just an interesting question for me, this idea of belief, right? Like, do you believe in XYZ tradition? And I think for me, through my studies, it was never a matter of, do I believe in it? It's a fact, it is. So it's not something you believe in, it's something you do. It's something that just exists around you. So even like the ideas that like magic can exist, that hexes can exist. And I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with this one book. It's a really popular book. It's called When the Wind Catches You and You Fall Down, something like that. And so it's about, you know, this little girl who's having seizures, and so the family goes on this whole, you know, quest with like Western medicine, trying to figure out, you know, how can we address the seizures and you know, how can we help her? And so the idea of, you know, you have these physical ailments, well, there are also spiritual ailments. And just like you would go to, you know, your doctor for an ailment, well, you could go to a medium and you can get, you know, you can go to a voodoo priestess, or you can go wherever and you can, or a botanica maybe, and you can get an herbal something or other, or a spell to address that. And that was always really fascinating to me, the idea that, you know, there were these material goods, there was a like a buying and selling and bartering that also came along with it. And so it wasn't just, you know, I guess the spirit of it, it was like the actual physical material goods that also held power, and how those goods are used to facilitate ritual. So that was a lot of my studies when I was here. That was a lot of the research I did. And so prefacing all of this was with that, then I guess the question is, well, how did you end up working at this leadership development nonprofit? How do you go from that to that? And so those when I ended up at COSSE, so I work for this leadership development program. It's a comprehensive scholarship program. Based in New York, and we have 10 offices, and I work out of the LA office. A lot of my work there was around facilitating questions of identity. So with our students, we're leading workshops on religious identity. We're talking about race and ethnicity. We're talking about gender and sexuality, class, all sorts of conversations that students, you know, experience when they get to college. And the great thing about our program is we're recruiting students from their junior year of high school for this leadership development program that they do their senior year of high school. And so they go through 8 months of training in their senior year. They're having these conversations and they're getting, I think, a leg up, or at least some more exposure than they might have otherwise, to difficult conversations that you experience in college. And so when they get to school, they know, right, like this is what to expect, or this is how you might engage with someone in conversation. There might be tension, there might be conflict, but you can get through that, right? And I think my studies in religion, well, I guess I'll just say my role now is a career program manager. And so I work with undergraduate students and alumni and helping them navigate the career path. And so one of the questions they always ask me is, oh, okay, so like, what did you study in school? And I say religion. And they're like, oh, well, how'd you end up here? And so I go through that whole long thing of like, this is what I did. That's how I ended up working in the nonprofit industry. And so they were like, oh, well, why not be a professor, or why not be anything else, I suppose. I think for me, I never approached my studies as, you know, there's just one trajectory and it's A to B in terms of what I do. I was always very open-minded about things I was interested in. So that's how I ended up working at Planned Parenthood, just because I was interested in reproductive justice. And I think I was always the kind of person who was just willing to take risks. So even if I didn't really understand what I was getting myself into, I just went for it anyway, just to see what would happen. And that was, you know, it would either turn out really great and I learned something, or it wasn't as great, but I still learned something. And I think that's the approach that when I'm working with students and I'm counseling them through academics, or I'm counseling them on, you know, should I take this internship, or I don't know what I'm doing with my life. All those questions come, I mean, they're really those fundamental questions of like, what am I passionate about? What am I here for? What's my purpose? And how do I make meaning in the world around me? So for me, that's a very direct connection from what it is I studied to what it is that I do practically for money. And one of the things I'm thinking about now that I think draws me back to religious studies and ritual is the ritual of going to work and how you change, how you're changed and how your environment changes when you cross that threshold from home to office or from home to classroom, like whatever that might be. Just because when I think about community, there is a community that develops when you go into to work. And I work in a very structured office sort of space. And so I'm spending time with people that I see far more than my loved ones. And so thinking about the community that's built there, there are rituals that happen, there are conflicts that happen. So I'm thinking of how do we create rituals that contribute to a healthier work environment that makes it, you know, a more productive place to be, where flow can happen, where people can be inspired. Those are all the questions that I'm thinking about now. And for me, it's still based in, you know, the things that I pursued in my research in religion, and applying that now, I guess, to the workplace. So those are things that I don't have answers to, and I've been out of school now for about 5 years, and I don't really have any more. I don't plan on returning for a master's degree for about maybe the next couple years or so, just because I really enjoy working. I'm not in any rush to go into graduate studies. I have an idea of what it is that I want out of those studies already. I'm interested in social work. I'd like to do some studies in organizational psychology. I'm just thinking about all of those things now, and I think I'm at a point where I'm at this organization. I've had a chance to be creative and grow. I'm working in service to students, which I'm really passionate about. And so from there, I'm thinking about my next move, and my next move can really be anything, just because I think for me, my baseline level of being happy is, you know, am I fulfilling my purpose? Do I feel like I'm being useful? Am I making some sort of meaningful impact on people in the world around me? And I think as long as I have those things, then I really can do anything. And so folks are like, well, what are you trying to do next? I'm like, I don't know, I might work on a college campus. Or what are you trying to do next? I'm like, I don't know, I might go work at a different nonprofit, or at least stay in the nonprofit industry, just because I like direct service work. Working with students is really fulfilling to me because I know what it's like to like be in those shoes. You don't know what you're doing. Somebody's out there looking out for you and counseling you along the way. And you know, being, you know, that cheerleader for you to make sure that you're achieving whatever it is that you envision for yourself. And if you don't really have that vision, right, then how are we being thought partners together to make that come to life? And how can I be somebody who serves as an intermediary or a connector to the resources and people that can help you in that journey? So that's why I love what I'm doing, and I hope to continue doing that. And then I think whatever comes next, I'm just going to be open to. I'm not really concerned about it. As long as I can pay my phone bill, have a roof over my head, and buy something nice for myself and my family every now and then I'm good. So that's what happened to me after this watch.